All right, well, thank you very much. I appreciate everybody hanging out to the bitter end, except for those of you streaming out to go to a better talk. Hey, I don't blame you. I'd be somewhere else, too, if I could. First, just to sort of set the stage a little bit, there's been a lot of really nice talks in this session. It's been really fun. I've never been to this particular meeting before, and it was great to get the invitation, and a lot of really nice synergies. So we're going to change gears a little bit. I think there's been a lot of work on observations and sort of reductionist models, and we're taking a really first principles type of an approach in our work. And, of course, I'd like to acknowledge my co-authors, Laura Condon, who's a PhD candidate in my group, and Stefan Collette, who's has a joint appointment at the Research Center in Jülich and Bonn University. And if you believe that, you know, Jeff's last set of slides was kind of this big excursion, this big experiment, I'm completely out there then by this by those sorts of standards. So what we've been looking at is this particular grand challenge that's been recently put forth a couple different ways of running integrated hydrologic models at these very large so-called continental scales at high resolution. And, you know, there's a lot of discussion about what is scale, what is continental scale, what is high resolution, you know, and that's all very well taken. And so just to think about some motivation or some reasoning for this, you know, interconnections within the hydrologic cycle have been shown to be very important. And there's some complexity to the water table depth over large continental scales, for example. Ying's work and then Anders Wormann's work showing, you know, topography and such affecting both water table depth and residence times. And then there's been a number of these workshops and opinion papers on this very topic. So, for example, here's the first of the hyper-resolution workshop paper. The second one was actually just accepted for publication. Mark Bierkens is the one that led up the second one, but this is pretty well-known Wood et al. Paper where they talk about the need for a grand challenge in understanding and monitoring Earth's terrestrial water. Tom Gleason and Mike Cardiff have written a similar, you know, return of groundwater quality, the future of our quantity, rather, and the sort of mega scale. And this is a figure I like quite a lot from Eric's paper, which shows fine-scale inundation at a whole range of scales over the Amazon basin. And we can see, you know, all the way down to the pixel scale, we see this strong spatial variability. So why should we do this, right? Why bother modeling at the continental scale, and why bother trying to, you know, tackle this kind of a problem? And the first questions really are like, is this even possible, right? Is this even a technologically achievable task? And the second one, which is sort of more important, is, you know, why should we do this? This is just saying, you know, my model can run on larger scales than yours, or is there, you know, some real scientific motivation here? And then, as the Bevan and Cloak comment so rightly pointed out, what about uncertainty, right? We have a lot of imperfect data sets. We've been talking about this a lot in this session, or others have been talking about this a lot in this session. And so it's really important to understand, you know, can we quantify this? And as I said earlier, I think there's these really important hydrologic questions that need to be approached at this scale, right? Anthropogenic change, atmospheric feedbacks, persistence of critical zones, and such. You know, we can observe them locally, but really taking this local connection out to these very large socially relevant scales, I feel, is very important. And I feel that as we do that, we don't really know what the dominant physical processes are. We don't think we have some good ideas, but I don't think that we really have an understanding of our scaling and organizational our processes, variables, and how we can guide observations sort of to close the scale gap. So there's a few different approaches that we might use. You could, of course, do reduced spatial resolution. This has been done quite a bit. Cloak et al., Vosmarty et al. Have done a lot with reduced spatial resolution sort of large-scale models. And then anything in the land surface modeling realm usually falls into this category. You can do reduced or simplified physics. I would put Ying's work in that category. I think it's great work. She linearizes the groundwater, doesn't include land surface processes explicitly. Or we can solve everything, which is what we're talking about. We really hit it with a big hammer, and our big hammer is called Euclean. It's a supercomputer that the Euler's Supercomputing Center has been gracious enough to give us a lot of computing time on. And our particular code scales very well out on this machine. And so this is an example from one of Stefan's papers that was in 2010 in Water Resources Research. And what he showed, this is actually 1 meter resolution, 5.6 by 5.6 or 32 square kilometer hypothetical catchment with strong anisotropy and heterogeneity. And this is probably the only soil moisture result I'm going to show. But what you see is you see strong anisotropy in the signal, and we can connect scales at which we believe these equations out to a large spatial extent through scaling. Well, at the end of that paper, we make the point that we could go out, you know, even farther. And the tool that we use for this is a tool we call PARFLOW. It's one of a growing number of integrated surface water groundwater models: Hydrogeosphere, CATHI, OpenGeoSys, the Penn State model, of course, NHM, or Integrated Hydrologic Model, which is the original. There are all these great models. We're forming this modeling community. We happen to use and develop PARFLOW in our group, but these models all function pretty similarly. They all solve variably saturated 3D Richards equation everywhere. We don't distinguish between surface and unsaturated and saturated flow. We let saturated flow develop where it will. We have coupled to it a form of the shallow water equation, so we have what we call the free surface overland flow boundary condition. This is really a fully integrated continuity plus Manning's and either the kinematic or diffusive wave. So we solve these two equations, mixed form of the Richards equation and a 2D form of the shallow water equations, of course without momentum terms. We solve these in a globally implicit manner. So every time step we solve this system of nonlinear diffusion equation in the subsurface, nonlinear wave equation at the surface flow in one simultaneous step. And then we have coupled to it, in this case, common land model, so the predecessor for the community land model. Stefan's group is actually coupled in, CLM-3.5, into this and using a slightly different framework, but same idea. And so we have this representation of all land surface processes, snow, radiation balance, and biogeochemistry. And the important thing here is this is fully coupled, it's fully mass conservative, and it's a highly scalable parallel implementation. And I'm not going to talk about the technical details of that very much, but there's a lot of references here that we could follow up with later. And so the way we tend to run this model is we set up a domain, we set up parameters, and then we force the model with observed meteorology. Or in this case, I'm going to be talking about some steady state simulations where we force the model with the observed P minus E product, and then we run the model to a steady state. We run the model to some set of conditions, and then we see how it does. And so there's not a calibration loop here. There could be, but we tend to think of this as a numerical experiment more than in the traditional modeling sense. So what we've done is we've built a proof of concept, 6.3 million square kilometer domain covering much of the continental U.S. So here's our domain. This has 1 kilometer lateral resolution, which I might argue is still pretty coarse, but it's, as I said, this is somewhat of a proof of concept model. We have variable resolution. We start out at 10 centimeters at the soil surface, and we go all the way down to about 102 meters of depth. It's really actually not all that small. It's only 32 million unknowns, which we've run out to tens of billions of unknowns, so this is a relatively small problem. We have the entire Mississippi and Colorado watersheds, and again, as I mentioned, this is fully integrated 3D Richards equation flow, shallow water equations, and we can include land surface processes, although I'm not going to talk about that here. So we wanted to construct this domain. We wanted to put this together using available data sets. And so the idea here is we grab everything that we can off the shelf that's freely available, knowing full well that there are imperfections and that there are ways that we might improve, which might be an entire research effort, but there are ways that one might improve these data sets. So we have topography, we have soil, we have a saturated hydraulic conductivity product, and we take a precipitation minus evaporation product, and we force this by this climatological P minus E, and we drive it from completely dry to a steady state simulation. And our topography and our soil properties come from the USGS hydrosheds and USGS other products. And our subsurface database comes from a Gleason et al. Product, and it's also somewhat modified by a basin and range assumption, which I can talk about. So what do we get when we run the simulation? So what happens is we don't actually specify where the rivers are. I mean, Hydrosheds is a some way a processed data set that has some notion of river flow. We don't use that at all. Rivers are generated when you have topographic convergence. You get some sort of ponding, either by excess infiltration or excess saturation. The river flows. That water is then routed. And our rivers, as you can see, as we zoom in, say, over the Ohio, we start, this is log flow. I should, of course, do exactly what I tell my students to do, which is describe the figure before you start talking about it. So this is log flow and cubic meters per second. And so we go all the way from a tenth of a cubic meter per second out to 10,000 cubic meters per second here. We can see that our headwater streams start. They then contribute to our tributaries, which then grow and build and form all of our major river systems. And so we have this huge multi-scale behavior across. We can do the same thing with groundwater depth. Now this is log water table depth, going from 100 meters to basically to a centimeter of water table depth. It's somewhat hard to see in the resolution because this model is just under 4,000 kilometers across, and this screen is not even 1,000 pixels across, so you're getting a large downscaling or large upscaling effect in this. Well, we can zoom in, say, on the North and South Platte, and we can see that we get fine-scale water table depth variation, some of which is topographically driven, some of which is driven by properties and recharge, et cetera, which we'll talk about a little bit. It's really important to note that this is completely unanthropogenic. We have no diversions, we have no dams, we have no water management, which we all know is a very important part of the system, and we have no groundwater pumping. So there's two very large anthropogenic signals that are not in this in the system, but it's still important to in this idea, to run this numerical experiment and then see, does the model perform in ways that even make sense, right? This could be that we're completely wrong and we get completely unrealistic behavior. So we can start to look at, this is the NASA Blue Marble image, which is a 1 kilometer worldwide, basically, satellite image. So we can use this to compare, do we even get the streams in the right place? Do we have, we have representation of flows. Of course, we don't have any anthropogenic influences on surface flow. But we do tend to get these pretty realistic patterns. Now, we know that our data sets are imperfect. And I think Tom's data set is a fantastic, this is the hydraulic conductivity data set, is a fantastic first step in this direction. But clearly, we see state and international breaks in the data sets used to assemble this data, right? I mean, this is the best that we have. And I think at one level, this points out that, yes, we need to improve this. But at another level, we can use this to start to understand how does our system behave? How does our system respond? And so, we're representing all of these different hydrologic states from these, range of resolutions. But we can really use this to understand process dependency on input data. So, for example, these slopes are all pretty mellow. This is log slope here. And we have really strong breaks in hydraulic conductivity. We have a nice break in potential recharge. This is our P minus C product. And if we zoom in on water table depth here, we see a clear relationship, of course, between water table depth and our potential recharge. That would follow. However, for a relatively similar potential recharge, and a similar slope, but a strong break in hydraulic conductivity, we see a really distinct break both in deeper water tables, and if we zoom in and look at, this is the surface stream network now, now we also see that deeper water tables, because of a higher hydraulic conductivity, give us a less dense stream network. So topographically, these streams could be flowing, but they're not because we have more subsurface flow and less surface flow, and then we have similar recharge. And so we can really start to parse out how slope, KSAT, and P minus E all contribute to our different model states and processes. Of course, we can compare to observations, and we've done this. So this is a roughly more than 4,000 gauge network product that Laura put together. Again, this is plotted in the same scale and such as the surface flow. So this is stream flow from more than 4,000 USGS gauging stations. What Laura did was she tried to screen a lot of them that had longer records so we could look at averages. Actually, we looked at averages. We've looked at 50th and 75th and 95th percentile statistics. I'm going to show some 50th and 75th percentile statistics. Again, these all have management in them. There's been no attempt to naturalize these. And then this is water table depth that Ying Fan shared with us. I credit her science paper, but this is also very similar data set from her 2007 paper. Again, complete with anthropogenic, and this is a much larger, this is more than 100,000 data sets. So how do we do? Well, we can do a very similar comparison to what Ying did in her 2007 paper, which is a pressure head versus predicted versus observed. Pressure head's important because this is actually what motivates our flow. Pressure head is somewhat, I'd say, obscuring because we have these giant ranges, and so it's really kind of hard to parse out whether this is topographically driven, whether this is elevation driven, or whether this is pressure driven. We can look at surface water flows. We can see surface water flows. We do pretty well. We tend to have a bias at very small flow values. I might argue this is a resolution dependency, that as we start to get lower flow values, that our 1 kilometer assumption just starts to break down in terms of resolution in the model. And what we can do is maybe look at histograms, we looked at histograms of various states. And so here's our hydraulic head. This is basically the exact same pressure head scatter plot you saw before. But now we can look at water table depth, which is effectively the residual of this. We see that, you know, we're simulating a little bit shallow. Now, this could be because there's more observations in deeper water table locations, or in this area right here, as we get deeper, this is the difference between observed and simulated. I might argue that this is probably also our groundwater pumping. This is our anthropogenic effect. We can look at both median and 75th observed flows. This is our same flow scatters, now parsed out. Might look like we're a little bit wet here, too. This might point to some biases in the P minus E product. But again, it's really hard to say what our steady state simulation, how that compares to a fully transient system. So we can parse this out by basin. This is the Snake, Missouri, Upper Mississippi, Great Basin, Upper Colorado, Ohio, etc. Basically, what we see is that we do really well in terms of water table depth in the Upper Colorado. We tend to have this shallow water table bias most other places. We can look at stream flow by basin, and we don't see a similar stream flow agreement, if you will. The stream flow bias is a little bit wet in the Upper Colorado, just like it is most other places. And so this points to maybe something a little bit more complex than just P minus E. And then lastly, in terms of the flow standpoint, we can start to understand how this behaves in terms of a scaling relationship, or how the system tells us, what the system tells us about scaling relationships. And so I'm plotting a really simple, this is sort of straight from Ignacio and Andrea's book. This is log flow in cubic meters per second and log drainage area. These are all of our model simulations, and these are our 4,000 plus gauging stations, and they're colored by aridity. And what we see is an overall trend which has a very similar slope, which is sort of always at our maximum aridity, so our maximum humidity, so our minimum aridity and maximum humidity. And we see a maximum behavior as these regions export and flow overland, we see a maximum, most likely P minus E and topographically driven behavior. And then as we move down, we see that each region has, or each point has a potential that may or may not be maximized in terms of its potential to generate runoff. Now, the last thing that we can do with this, and I'm glad, Jeff, that you're still in the audience, because I showed this 2 weeks ago to the day in Vancouver, and you just stepped out when I showed this slide. I know. And so we can use these models to predict stream water age and residence times and composition. I argue, and I think I've got some fellow voices in the choir in this room, that understanding these understanding these resonance times, how old stream water is, these are really pretty fundamental questions that I don't think that we really have a good handle on yet. There's a lot of great work on this, but I don't think we have a good handle on this. And just a quote from this paper, what are the physical processes and material properties that control transit times distributions, and how do these processes vary with time, ambient conditions, and place? So what we did was something very similar to work that Stefan and I did a long time ago over the Lulawashta, which we should play a drinking game the number of times the Lulawashta has been mentioned in this particular session. I've done a lot of work myself in the Lulawashta. And here's a pictorial of what we did in the Lulawashta. We have rivers, and we identified river locations, and we used a particle tracking, Lagrangian particle tracking approach to tag particles in the stream bed. We reverse the velocities, and then we trace them backwards to their source. So particles start here, they run backward. At this point, we were worried about the water table and the land surface. In the CONUS, we're just doing this every stream, tracing the particle back to its source location at the land surface. And so what does this look like? Well, this is what this looks like. We have water as young as a tenth of a year, water predicted as old as 10,000 years in the simulation. And it may look like we have really distinct regions over the CONUS. We have maybe younger water in the headwaters. We have some really old water, particularly in the Great Plains system. But as we zoom in, we actually see this is really kind of a bias of our resolution, and that we can usually find old and young water juxtaposed next to each other almost everywhere in the domain. Now, we do have generally regions of older and younger water, but what we have is we have this, and I think it is from, I have a master's student who's working on diagnosing this, but it looks like it's a pretty clearly fractal data set where we have a spatial distribution, a fractal spatial distribution of our residence times. And, sure, last slide here, so perfect timing. And so lastly, we can treat this like a residence time distribution, and we can look at the residence times as a mass fraction versus time and year for the entire domain, and this is what we get for residence time. This is log-log scale. And then we could break these out by the Colorado-Missouri snake, which we were also calling the Pacific Northwest and other figures, Upper Missouri, Arkansas Red, and we see a couple distinct things. One, we see some median residence time. So the median residence time for our CONUS is about 8 years, but clearly we have a very broad distribution of residence times. Now, that we have a broad distribution of residence times, this is not a new thing. But that we can arrive at a broad distribution of residence times from basically flow and transport assumptions that are first principles based, I would argue is a really a step in this direction. We can also see that our different basins, Colorado, Missouri, or Colorado tends to be young. The Arkansas tends to be older. Some look like they're bimodal. We might have multiple peaks. And they all have a pretty clear power law tail. And this also is probably a power law approach, too. So to wrap up and leave us a little bit of time for a discussion, I believe that we're really moving forward in terms of using integrated models to understand connections within the hydrologic cycle. I think that we see this complex scaling behavior of flow and residence times. This isn't just a simple linear combination of topography and hydraulic conductivity. And we can tackle these grand challenge problems using computational hydrology. Not the only way, but I think it's an important way. And it's really important that we can make these predictions of all these hydrologic states from really small to really large resolutions that's, of course, of interest to stakeholders and the public. So thanks again for the very nice invitation, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions.
Jeff.
So those transit time estimates at the end,
yes.
They were groundwater or is this stream water?
This is groundwater only. So this is a groundwater contribution. So we start in the stream and we run backwards to the ground surface. So they're saturated, unsaturated. The big thing that we assume here, and we don't have to do this, but the big thing that we assume here is that the stream residence time is much smaller than the groundwater residence time. And this is the groundwater residence time only, and it's steady state. So
So this is very exciting. We've just done an analysis of 230 watersheds across the U.S. They're mean transit time of the stream water.
Okay.
Based on some USGS data from Kendall and Copeland.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, it's much younger, as you say. In fact, if we look at the distribution, the median transit time for stream water might be on the order of 3 to 6 months.
Okay.
And
that
it goes
makes
from,
sense.
And it's kind of less skewed. We're kind of blind using stable isotopes to water older than 5 or 6 years. But it would be so interesting to kind of compare those two data sets because, of course,
I could not agree more. Yeah, I could not agree more. I think that, and my feeling is to just discuss more about this, is I think it's really important to sort of put ourselves out there. I mean, you know, this is a pre-development model, right? This is a built on first principles on data sets that we know are imperfect. But I think we get a character of residence times that makes a lot of sense given other pieces of observation. We put this out there and we say, okay, now we need to look for this. We need to go start to refine this whole process with other observations, with other theory, and really to start to understand how these systems scale and behave in a way not to say that we always need to run, you know, on a supercomputer every time we want to make a prediction, but that we can use these as the basis for connecting other pieces within the system. Of course, observations are incredibly important, and of course, scale and theory is really important. And we use this as a way sort of to bridge these different pieces.
Can you say a little more about, you said that the precipitation minus evaporation is an input. Can you say more about?
Sure, yeah. So this is the standard UW product. This is Amara et al. VIC-derived product. So it's basically PRISM plus VIC. The next step in this work is to run fully integrated with Parflow CLM. We've actually done a number of test runs. I'm actually running all this myself. So I've done a number of test runs where we've used NLDAS, so the NLDAS product, which is at 12 kilometers, and then we drive basically Parflow CLM, and so we don't have any P minus E. It's completely dynamically calculated. But in this case, to drive the model towards equilibrium, we imposed that UW P minus E product onto the model, both as a way to spin up, but then also just as a simulation in and of itself, to sort of simplify the, you know, the number of jumps here.